Morning, judges. Sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. Counsel's ready. You may begin. Please state your appearance.
Thank you, judges. May it please the court. My name is Kish Gabani. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office, representing petitioner appellant, Mr. Fernando Almanza. And I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal, but I'll watch the clock. Judges, this case is about how Mr. Almanza, an illiterate man with cognitive dysfunction, never received competent counsel at any stage of his state proceedings. At trial, a key witness with a clear motive to lie had a clear motive to lie, and the prosecutor told the jury several times that the witness had nothing to gain from testifying. Now, Mr. Almanza's trial attorney did nothing to elicit that motive or object to the prosecutor's inaccurate statements. On appeal, his counsel knew he was illiterate, but only sent him a misleading letter stating his case was over. Now, the district court order denying relief failed to recognize the significance of this abandonment, and its timeliness determination was wrong. I'd like to start by discussing timeliness at issue one, more specifically relation back. Now, the district court's determination that the relevant claim in its amended petition, the ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim, IAC for short, that it did not relate back to the original petition is wrong. The district court found the original pro se petition to be about investigation and not about trial. But in that petition, in his pro se petition, Mr. Almanza contended that his Sixth Amendment right to counsel had been violated, partly because his trial counsel had not addressed Mr. Boggs' plea deal, that's a key witness, had not addressed his deal at trial, nor objected at trial. Moreover, the district court incorrectly interpreted his claim to be about his counsel's failure to obtain Mr. Boggs' plea agreement. But that is also wrong. Mr. Almanza's counsel had the plea agreement. He said so at trial. And the detail in the pro se petition also indicates that Mr. Almanza had that plea agreement, or at least knew its terms. Now, in his amended petition, the IAC claim was based on his trial counsel's failure to meaningfully cross-examine Mr. Boggs about his plea deal and counsel's failure to object to prosecutorial misconduct involving the same plea deal. In short, both petitions involve the same actor, his trial counsel, the same topic, that's Mr. Boggs' plea deal, and the same inaction occurring at the same time, that's his attorney's failure to address the deal at trial. Now, even if the court finds ambiguity in Mr. Almanza's pro se petition, both the Supreme Court and this court have repeatedly stated that pro se petitions are to be construed liberally and with deference to the petitioner. And because the...
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, Judge.
Wanting to know, maybe you can walk us through Mr. Almanza's attempts to seek assistance from paralegals in the ADCRR in his ability or inability to do so.
Yes, Judge.
Because I ask this because there doesn't seem to be anything in the record of these attempts or an affidavit from your client attesting to any kind of failed attempts. So I don't know if you can point to me in the record something I missed or...
Well, Judge, the district court requested essentially an evidentiary hearing in 2 weeks. And, we presented these facts at the oral argument evidentiary hearing. And it wasn't really an evidentiary hearing because we had 1 week to prepare and it was at the height of COVID. So we limited access to Mr. Almanza. But according to the oral argument in which, the appellees not contested any of the facts presented in that oral argument or in the briefing. But in December 2014, that was the first instance when Mr. Almanza had been released from isolated custody in which he was only with one other prisoner. He sought assistance from prison paralegals, and they denied his request, saying that his appellate counsel would contact him and answer those questions. Now, Judge, in the record, the district court tried to determine when the prison paralegals had offered assistance to Mr. Almanza, and the first time that the paralegals had assisted him was well into 2016, early 2016, February 2016, so well after his federal petition was due. So that was the first, they conceded that that was the first time that they did assist him.
I guess what's your best argument or authorities that Mr. Alonso experienced extraordinary circumstances that would require equitable tolling?
Sure, Judge. So I believe it's important to understand the standard here, that we agree that Mr. Almaza filed a timely pro se petition. But just because he filed a timely pro se petition, the claims as amended petition, just because he did not include the claims as amended petition in the timely petition, doesn't mean that he's precluded from equitable tolling. In Foué versus Bider from this court, an en banc decision, states that strict impossibility is not the standard for pro se petitioners. It's just because he could have included those claims, the amended claims, claims the amended petition in his pro se petition, that does not preclude him from equitable tolling. That Gibbs versus LeGrand also states that, that strict impossibility is not the standard for pro se petitioners. Now, Judge, Mr. Almaza believed that he could exhaust the claims that were in his federal amended petition. The amended petition, he believed that he could exhaust those claims in state court. And that is not an unreasonable belief. The state represented to the, or excuse me, the appellees represented to the district court that he could avail himself of statutory tolling. They believed that his state PCR proceedings were pending. That's in docket 24. They stated that his proceedings were pending and that he could go back to state court or exhaust those proceedings before returning to federal court. Now, Judge, it's also important here to note that Mr. Almaza filed a federal habeas petition, a pro se petition, while his state proceedings were pending. Now, this court in Rudin versus Miles, this court in Gibbs versus LeGrand states that to expect a pro se petitioner to file a habeas petition while his PCR proceedings are ongoing raises diligence from reasonable diligence to maximum feasible diligence. And that's for a literate prisoner. Mr. Almaza was obviously illiterate, so the standard should be lower for him. So I believe, Judge, that with the district court's reliance on the district court's orders providing Mr. Almaza with additional time to prepare his petition, that is another extraordinary circumstance warranting equitable tolling here.
Are you referring, counsel, to the June 2016 order?
Correct.
And did you waive argument regarding that order by not proceeding below on that?
You mean in state court or?
In the district court.
The court provided Mr. Almaza with additional time, and then Mr. Almaza used that time to attempt to exhaust his claims in state court.
I just have one other question for you. You argued that Mr. Almanza's appellate counsel adequately, if Almanza's appellate counsel had adequately apprised him of the Arizona Court of Appeals affirming his conviction, he could have filed a timely PCR notice. I'm just curious, what would you describe as adequate notice?
Well, Judge, his appellate counsel, after receiving the issuance of the mandate, she was still his counsel as of record in the Arizona Court of Appeals. Once she received the issuance of the mandate, she should afford that to him. In Maples versus Thomas, U.S. the Supreme Court states that abandonment when counsel was still counsel of record and never withdrew. So the petitioner in that case never received notice from the court. So it's the same standard here.
Would a letter written in English called him to deliver that news? What would have been adequate notice?
Yes, Judge. A call with the aid of an interpreter, or going to the prison to meet with Mr. Almaza with an interpreter would have sufficed. If there are no additional questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, please state your appearance.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Andrew Riley, and I'm appearing on behalf of respondents in this matter. The district court correctly held that the amended petition was untimely and that Almanza was not entitled to any equitable tolling, let alone equitable tolling that would be sufficient to make the very untimely amended petition otherwise timely. The question before the court is not whether petitioner's state PCR petition is entitled to some tolling. The question is whether the federal deadline was entitled to tolling. And as the record shows, Mr. Almanza did in fact file a timely federal habeas petition. His counsel apprised him of that his appeal had failed, and that she was not going to pursue it any further. That letter was translated to him. The point earlier, there had never been any complaint as far as I can find in the record of Almanza not being able to obtain translation services from other inmates. The first instance, I believe, is it might be the appointment of counsel at ER 30405, where he has said that his inmate helper is going to be transferred out, and so he was seeking appointment of counsel, but there's nothing to suggest that he hadn't received services. The Arizona Department of Corrections policy provides services upon request. Shortly thereafter, there was a letter in the record, ER 291, the correspondence to the AG's office, where at best there's a line that says that the paralegal is not particularly cooperative, according to Almanza. But there's nothing that suggests that something was so severe that it prevented him from doing so or from filing a timely petition, because again, he did in fact file a timely petition in this case. The four distinct groups were that Almanza identifies as entitling him to equitable tolling were correctly rejected by the R&R and adopted by the district court's order. And frankly, the analysis and the stop clock kind of approach is just not the correct approach in this equitable tolling analysis. And it's important to note that for a number of years, Almanza wasn't pro se. He was in fact represented by habeas counsel, and any miscalculation of the time that took place here isn't sufficient to warrant equitable tolling in the circumstances. As far as the relation back, to touch on that quickly, in looking at Almanza's original petition, if just looking at the plain language of his petition, Almanza believed that Mr. Boggs was a government agent or a government actor, and that was his complaint. His counsel didn't object into investigating that fact, and why Boggs would infiltrate his materials and befriend him to gain a better plea deal, whereas the claim in the amended petition is very different. It's a prosecutorial, the failure to object to a prosecutorial, so alleged misconduct in vouching for Boggs and eliciting false testimony of some benefit that Boggs didn't believe he obtained, because again, he received, his first plea was for a year and a half sentence and his second plea was for a year and a half sentence. So there's no difference to Boggs' mind that he didn't get any benefit, and he testified as such. And regardless, again, that IAC claim is procedurally defaulted and it can't be excused by Martinez, because ultimately Almanza's was responsible for the procedural default. It had nothing to do with habeas counsel and PCR counsel failure to raise the claim to the Arizona Court of Appeals, because again, nothing was properly before the court, before the state court. So no IAC claim could be adjudicated on the merits.
Counsel, if you assume arguendo that we disagree with you on that last point on Martinez, what is your position on whether we are able to make the decision ourselves that the claim was substantial, or should remand it to the district court?
I think it's clear on the record that the claim is not substantial from the state's perspective. Again, at best, the only difference between the two plea agreements is whether or not he's charged with or he receives a felony conviction for a Class 4 felony versus a Class 6 felony. And as mentioned in the record, quite frankly, Boggs' criminal history, where I think at that point he had 14 criminal convictions or something at that point. So the difference between a class 4 and a class 6 is de minimis or insignificant. And again,
the important part of that isn't whether he received a concrete benefit that would seem large. It seems to me that the issue is whether he lied in front of the jury when he said he received nothing. And so whether he received something small or large doesn't really take away from the lie. And it seems to me that that is something that fundamentally changes potentially a jury's view of a witness when it can be shown to be lying, which he wasn't. And that issue is raised in his, it's not raised very elaborately or well, but it is raised at ER 315 in the original habeas petition. Why does it matter, in your view, whether the benefit was small?
Well, I don't think it matters. It matters in the sense that as a practical matter, as an objective matter, there's very little there. And as a subjective matter under Boggs, my reading of the testimony is that in his mind, he emphasizes that I was a year and a half before and a year and a half after. And he had already served the sentence and there's no going, there's no going back. In fact, the only way you could go back would be if he in fact testified falsely. I mean, if anything, it indicates that he would testify truthfully.
Well, he said he was, after you talked to Detective Snyder, did any of that change? And he said no. And so that answer was not true, regardless of the size of, because there was a change. After he talked to Snyder, the classification was changed. Now, the fact that he then says, well, it was minimal, that's true, and that's true certainly in his both objectively and subjectively, but it troubles me, I'll just say that. But it sounds to me like you don't have any objection to this court making that determination as to whether or not there's a substantial question.
I would object. I don't think it's a substantial question. I do think it's not a substantial claim. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, the failure to impeach on the failure to point out to the jury that you said no error or that there was no difference between the plea agreement. Well, this one says class 4 and this one says class 6. Everything else is essentially the same outside of also the underlying conviction too was an aggravated assault versus a different thing. But I don't, again, pointing that out to the jury is rather insignificant in regards to the fact that, again, his sentence didn't change at all. You have all the corroborating evidence of the injuries to the victim, the testimony of the victim, and everything, it's the grand scheme of things. So the idea that I just don't see it's a substantial claim because of, in context.
Let me ask you a question. During the period that Mr. Alonzo sought assistance, how were the accommodations described in the ADCR's policy manual provided to inmates with significant impairments? I'm just trying to figure out how inmates were apprised of accommodations, and I guess Mr. Alonzo in particular.
We just have the ADC guidelines, and I don't have anything from, I don't know what was specifically told to Almanza or what wasn't told to Almanza. And again, it's not necessarily to what was affirmatively given to him. There are these resources available, and you have to ask for them. You can't not ask for them and then say they were never given to me. So these resources were available, and and he has to avail himself of that, and he has to show, you know, there needs to be sufficient evidence and a sufficient showing that, look, I tried to do it on this, you know, at this time, and at this time, and at this time, and it kept being rebuffed, and we just don't have that here. In fact, you know, after the motion for appointment of counsel, the respondents were instructed by the magistrate and the district court judge to do that for, essentially for Almanza, to contact the paralegal and to get, have her, the paralegal services get in touch with Almanza, and that happened right away. So, I mean, there's just no, there's nothing that I have come across, or that I can recollect coming across in the record, where Almanza said he's affirmatively tried to do X on a certain day, and it was denied him in that regard. And again, it's his burden to do so, to avail himself of the, to attempt to avail himself of those things. And I see that I'm past my time, I more than once.
But I think what he asserts is that he learned that he could seek paralegal assistance from other inmates once he was released into the general population in December of 2015. And it's my understanding he's illiterate and he doesn't speak English. By this point, it seems like the PCR notice was already untimely. So I'm just trying to figure out if you agree that Mr. Alonso's lack of notice about this assistance impeded his ability to file PCR notice and petition.
Again, I don't, the material, or the availability of, as far as I am aware, and I could be mistaken, but the availability of, to avail himself of those services in his initial custody situation was still available to him. But to the underlying analysis, the equitable tolling goes to the federal, to the ability to file a federal claim. So if it might give you a little bit in that regard, but it doesn't affect the ability. The question before this court is not the state timeliness analysis for the state PCR proceeding. That's already been resolved, and there's, you know, that can't be corrected now. And then he's aware and known that it's untimely. You have to proceed towards the next step, which would be the federal petition.
Thank you. I think there's any other questions. Thank you.
Then we can just ask that you affirm, affirm the district court's denial of habeas relief. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Giovanni, I don't think you have, I'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. Just two quick points. Again, Mr. Almanza, he received a letter from his appellate counsel. He tried to obtain paralegal assistance in December 2014. He never got that. And, in the letter that the court pointed out, I believe the appellees pointed out, he stated that paralegals were not cooperative with him. And that when he did seek paralegal assistance, the paralegal recommended or advised that he give up his federal habeas proceedings, but he did not abide by that. So the paralegals were not assisting him in any helpful way, really. So, but Judge, the second point I'd make is about the substance of the claim, the substance of the trial IAC claim. Appellees seem to keep stating that Mr. Bond said two plea agreements. It was 1.5 years in the first, 1.5 years in the second, and that there was no benefit. But the first plea was gone. The first plea was withdrawn. It was off the table. And so what matters here is if he did not cooperate with the state in his testimony, the 1.5 years would have become almost 15 years due to his original charges being reinstated. So it's not the original plea that would have been reinstated. It's the original charges that would have been reinstated, which obviously much more than 1.5 years. If there are any additional questions, or if there are no additional questions, I would ask that you reverse the district court.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. Appreciate your argument presentations here today. The case of Fernando Almanza versus David Shin is now submitted.